Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. It's now early AD 54. Seneca has been keeping his political head down, seemingly satisfied with educating the young Nero, Claudius's heir designate, and enjoying the literary prestige that was a byproduct of his position as tutor, and that absolutely everyone wanted to read the output of the man whose thinking was supposedly going to influence the behaviour of their next ruler. As for the emperor himself, Claudius was 62 years old as the year began, and he'd been on the throne for just on 13 years. His survival in the top job was attributable to a keen innate intelligence, the maintenance of a select inner circle loyal only to T to counter-attack ruthlessly whenever his regime was threatened. At times, he'd had to resort to extreme measures. In a lampoon circulated shortly after Claudius's death, which is attributed to Seneca and which I'll deal with in more depth towards the end of this podcast, the long-dead and now deified ex-emperor Augustus stands up during a heavenly debate and catalogues the escalating butchery of his descendant Claudius. Although that book, the Apocolicentosis, was designed to lampoon Claudius, Seneca would have been referring to recognisable events when he had Augustus accuse Claudius of murdering two of Augustus's great-granddaughters, one of Augustus's great-great-grandsons, Claudius's ex-wife Messalina, who was another blood descendant of Augustus, and a whole raft of patricians and nobles from high-born families. And it wasn't just the emperor. Claudius's empress Agrippina had also been busy. She'd been building up a power base of her own. By early AD 54, she'd succeeded in having her creatures installed into key positions. Seneca was tutor to her son Nero, and Afranius Burrus, who was now commander of the Praetorian Guard, which we must remind ourselves was the only legitimately armed outfit allowed within the city of Rome itself. In addition, she'd been slowly building up a faction in the Senate. Some that possessed something she coveted, she had removed and often destroyed. Others that posed a potential threat to her son's future, she had killed. Those no longer of use to her, she had replaced with ones that were. But probably most alarmingly, for Claudius anyway, she'd made inroads into seducing away the emperor's trusted cabal of freedmen who, because he had handpicked and elevated them himself, had previously been loyal to him alone. Some of them remained steadfast, but one of the most influential, Pallas, whom Agrippina singled out for a special favour, monetary riches and political prestige, was now firmly on the empress's team, and was even rumoured to have become her lover. So both Claudius and Agrippina, it would seem, had been chucking their political weight around in ways that were no longer subtle or justifiable. But Claudius's own power base was slowly eroding around him. The young heir apparent, Nero, was, under Seneca's tutelage, growing up fast, and Nero's mother, Agrippina, sensing the pieces of her long-term strategy clicking into place, was positioning herself to strike. Claudius's self-made luck began to run out. As AD 54 dawned then, in terms of the snake pit that was the Julio-Claudian succession, Claudius was essentially a dead man walking. The year opened with dire portents. According to the ancient commentators, the omens predicted a change to evil times. The tents and standards of some soldiers were ignited by lightning. A swarm of bees settled on the pediment of the Capitoline Temple. And more sensationally, It was reported that women were giving birth to children that were half beast, half human. And, perhaps most bizarrely of all, a pig was seen, which, instead of the normal trotters, had the claws of a hawk. As the year AD 54 progressed, it became increasingly apparent that all was not well up at the royal palace. Reports from the ancient commentators, some of whom lived through the times, others write in a good generation or two later, are slightly confused and even at times contradictory. But it is evident that a lot of political manoeuvring and high-level plotting was taking place. The scent of imminent treason, maiestas as the Romans called it, hung heavy in the imperial corridors of power. Now, it would be fantastic if something from Seneca, a man at the very epicentre of the unfolding events, had survived to give us a record of what was going on around him at the time. But it doesn't, at least not in the works that have come down to us. You see, Seneca had long learned not to openly come out on anybody's side, and, true to form, his prose works, even those written soon after this critical period, contain very little outside reference. But that's not to say there are no tantalising little hints here and there, and I'll attempt to include them where I can. For now, though, I'll have to rely on the testimonies of Tacitus, Flavius Josephus, Suetonius, Cassius Dio, and the elder Pliny, and those commentators will walk us through what is most likely to have happened as that fateful year of AD 54 unfolded. The first thing we have to remember is that Claudius was no fool, far from it. He could see exactly which way the political wind was blowing. Sure, he'd adopted Nero as his heir. He'd even married Agrippina's son to Octavia, his own natural daughter, by Messalina, his previous wife. But events were starting to take a dangerous turn. And I'd say it goes without saying that he was fully aware of Agrippina's net tightening around him. She had control of a part of Claudius's protective circle through Pallas. She had control of the Praetorian Guard through Burrus, and she had control of Claudius's adopted heir, Nero, through Seneca. Claudius, as he always did when his tolerance and patience were running out, and he was beginning to sense the stability of the state was in danger, decided to act. He was probably, by this stage, beginning to regret marrying his uber-ambitious niece. But she was as smart as he was, and she wouldn't prove as easy to get rid of as the promiscuous Messalina, Claudius's last wife, to have overstepped the mark. So Claudius was forced to act, but for once, the emperor who loved to gamble played his cards the wrong way, and what he did next would be the equivalent of signing his own death warrant. The accounts suggest that Claudius began to openly let it be known that he was thinking of re-elevating Britannicus, his natural son by Messalina, above Nero in the imperial succession. There's even a hint, albeit from the rather sensationalist Suetonius, that had been Claudius's intention all along, and that he had only initially nominated Nero as his heir in order to protect Britannicus from an early death at the hands of hostile factions while the child was growing to manhood. Now, personally, I do think that's a possibility. Claudius was certainly smart enough to deflect jealous attention from his natural child by naming Agrippina's son as heir. I mean, Claudius is even credited with having said, whilst embracing Britannicus, "Grow up quickly, my boy, and I will then explain what my policy has been." In addition, during one of his last visits to address the Senate, Claudius is supposed to have offered earnest pleas for harmony between his natural and adopted sons. So it's not, I think, entirely outside the realms of possibility that Claudius was playing the long game to preserve Britannicus's life in the face of Axum. But whether re-elevating Britannicus was pre-planned or not, the ancient accounts all agree that Claudius made no secret that was his intention, and Agrippina became aware of it very quickly. On the strength of that intention, Claudius is said to have composed his will and had it witnessed by all the magistrates, and it was that act which forced Agrippina's hand, especially when, according to Tacitus, who is one of the more reliable commentators, Claudius had remarked to Agrippina that it was in his own nature to first endure the misdemeanors of his wives before punishing them, and that remark was an open threat, as it was an allusion back to Messalina, whose bad behaviour Claudius had tolerated for a long time before having her executed. For Agrippina, then, the alarm bells started clanging. She knew that her more unsavoury political manoeuvrings and preemptive eliminations of rivals of royal blood were coming under ever-increasing scrutiny and criticism. She also knew that Narcissus, a freedman still loyal to Claudius, had long suspected her scheming ways and was accusing her of an affair with Pallas. So she no longer had a choice. Agrippina had to act swiftly, and so she sprang into action. Nearly all the ancient commentators report the belief that Claudius was murdered. Some state it outright, others are a little more guarded. The only exception to these is Seneca, whose comic account of Claudius's death as a natural one is given in the Apocolican Ptosis, the lampoon I mentioned earlier in this podcast. There are several reasons why I believe that Seneca gave a specious account of Claudius's death and portrayed it as natural rather than the murder that all the other evidence points to, but I'll deal with that issue later in this podcast. Firstly, though, let's look at the events as they are reported to have panned out. Claudius's intention to re-elevate Britannicus and the making of a will to that effect meant that Agrippina and, by extension, her son Nero were now in a precarious position. If she did nothing, her own status, not to mention life, would be in danger, and it was highly likely that Nero, demoted to a spear in the Julio-Claudian pecking order, might also anticipate a truncated life expectancy. Assassination or murder was often the fate of those who posed too great a threat to a nominated heir, who, in the new scenario, would be Britannicus. So, left with no alternative and with time running out, Agrippina decided that Claudius had to go before the new succession was announced. The ancient accounts agree that Agrippina chose a family banquet as the setting for her deed. Her weapon was poison, and her medium, a dish of succulent mushrooms, one of Claudius's favourite foods. It's obvious that Agrippina had put a lot of spadework into her scheme. She was extremely well prepared, because it would appear she had her own people spread throughout the royal household, all poised and ready to cover any eventuality. She'd enlisted the skills of a notorious poison mixer named Locusta to prepare the deathly mixture, and had brought over to her own party Claudius's food taster, the eunuch Halotus. As a fallback, she also had Claudius's physician, Xenophon, in her pay. See, this was all a well-plotted conspiracy against the emperor's life. The surviving accounts of how the murder played out are all variations on the flowing narrative, with each variation containing some or all of the elements I'm about to recount. Locusta, the poison maker, sprinkled her brew on a particularly juicy-looking mushroom in a dish that was one of Claudius's favourites. The emperor's food taster, Helotus, was advised what parts of the dish to avoid, and so Claudius duly consumed the poisoned item. But at this point, a problem arose, because Claudius was already quite sloshed, and all the introduction of the poisoned mushroom into a stomach already full of booze served to achieve was to make him start vomiting. That act, of course, rid Claudius's system of most of the poison. But Agrippina was prepared for this eventuality. She called immediately for the physician, Xenophon, who rushed in holding a feather, which he then stuck down Claudius's throat, and that was a standard procedure for helping a patient vomit up the contents of their stomach. Agrippina, though, had instructed the physician to soak the feather in the same poison that Locusta had prepared for the mushrooms, and this time the toxin took hold and Claudius collapsed. Some accounts give a slight variation on this sequence. Administration, the poison worked. Claudius lost his powers of speech, suffered terrible pain, and died just before dawn. Another option is that after the first dose, he fell into a coma, vomited up all his food, and was then poisoned a second time with gruel or by an enema. But all accounts agree that Claudius, Emperor of Rome, fourth of the Julio-Claudian line, died on the 13th of October, AD 54. Now, we do have to be a bit careful with these ancient reports of the assassination, because Agrippina, as Nero's mother, was an easy and obvious target for commentators writing under later dynasties with their own propaganda agendas and political axes to grind. In addition, in the account of events I've just related, Agrippina reads or comes across like the archetypal scheming, poison-administering, wicked stepmother who crops up as a character stereotype over and over again in Roman literature, especially in the suasorii and controversii, which were key tools in a Roman boy's rhetorical education. So it's fair to say that when you take a step back and read the historical accounts objectively, the whole thing does sound rather contrived and far-fetched. The question is then, can we take any of it at face value? Well, in my opinion, Agrippina was in a desperate position. Did she have Claudius done away with? I'd say yes. But did it happen exactly as the ancient commentators report it? The answer to that is probably not exactly, although I don't think their version of events is too far from the truth. Agrippina was a smart woman, smart and ambitious. By making it known he was re-elevating Britannicus, Claudius had forced her into taking a gamble. But it was a very well-prepared gamble, and she made absolutely sure that she shortened the odds against herself as best she could. More importantly, though, it was how events were managed immediately after the murder, rather than the sensationalist accounts of the assassination itself, that tell me Agrippina's hand was orchestrating the whole affair. But before we get into that, let's hear the words of the elder Pliny, who, unlike many of the other commentators cited here, actually lived through the events in question, although he was admittedly abroad on military service in AD 54 itself. His comment on the episode is as terse as it is damning. Agrippina, he said, poisoned Claudius with mushrooms, thereby bringing her own poison upon the world in the form of Nero. The elder Pliny then was in no doubt whatsoever about who was driving events. We've got to rely, though, on the other ancient commentators, Tacitus, Suetonius, Cassius Dio, and Josephus Flavius, to give us a consensus on what happened next. So once the poison had been administered, Claudius's possibly already dead body was whisked away from public view, and the Senate was summoned to assemble to offer prayers for the emperor's safety. Some reports say that Agrippina even went to the lengths of having a troupe of actors, Claudius's favourite entertainment, summoned to the palace to feed the illusion that Claudius was still conscious. While the subterfuge was being enacted, Agrippina was organising furiously behind the closed doors of the palace. Faking her own grief, or so say the commentators, and under the pretense of protecting them, she had Claudius's natural children, Britannicus and his two sisters, confined to their rooms. She then summoned her muscle, Burrus, commander of the Praetorian Guard, and had all approaches to the palace sealed off by his troops. When everything was ready, at around midday on October the 13th, AD 54, the palace gates were flung open to reveal Nero and Burrus standing side by side. Burrus hailed Nero as a new emperor to his troops and had the young man whisked off to the safest place in the city, the Praetorian barracks, where, in a gesture that mimicked that of his predecessor Claudius, who'd been in the exact same position some 13 years previously, he promised every Praetorian officer and soldier a hefty financial reward for their loyalty. Once the army had hailed Nero as their new imperator, the Senate and then all the Roman provinces had no real option but to follow suit. But during all of this, neither sight nor sound of Britannicus was forthcoming. He was kept safely out of the way. There was only one new emperor on offer on the 13th of October, AD 54, and that emperor was Agrippina's son, Nero. So Burrus, Agrippina's man in command of the Praetorians, her muscle, was definitely complicit in all of these goings-on. So she was definitely pulling his strings, but what about Seneca? What was his involvement in all of this? What role, if any, did he play in what was essentially Agrippina's coup d'etat? Well, reading between the lines, Seneca was also involved in it up to his eyeballs. There's simply no way he couldn't have known what was going on. The commentator Cassius Dio says that Nero's speech to the Praetorian guards after he'd been safely conveyed to their barracks had been pre-prepared by Seneca. Now that would be about right, as Seneca asked the Praetorians to secure their loyalty in the past, more or less instructed Nero to promise the same thing. The same commentator also claims that Seneca composed a similar speech for Nero that was delivered shortly afterwards to the Senate. So if Burrus was the new regime's muscle, then Seneca can be said to have been its mouthpiece, albeit proxied through the mouth of the young Nero. And behind them both was Agrippina, and she was pulling everybody's strings. As far as Seneca's involvement is concerned, we also have to take a look at the Apocolic Entosis, a political satire, which was later attributed to Seneca, that was anonymously circulated shortly after Claudius's death. It was probably written to coincide with the Saturnalia festival that took place in the December of every year. In that lampoon, Seneca, alone among the surviving accounts, implies that Claudius died a natural death, the result of a life of overindulgence. Comical and derisory though the episode is made to sound, it does smack of propaganda, a jocular attempt to mask what really happened. And I say that because at times the mask slips. At one point, Seneca, in a scene involving the god Mercury and one of the fates, Clotho, has the two of them working out exactly when to end Claudius's time on Earth. In a line taken from Virgil's Georgics, Seneca has Mercury say of Claudius, Dede neci, milio vacuacine regnet in aula, give him up to be slaughtered, he says. Let his better reign in the vacated court. Now, although the passage in Virgil's Georgics is ostensibly about rival bee swarms battling for mastery of the hive, the Roman ear was very well attuned to its analogy of intra-dynastic imperial rivalries. And Seneca, as I'll explain in later podcasts, was very acutely aware of that fact. I'll discuss the lampoon, the apocolicentosis, in a lot more depth in the next podcast, along with the events in the immediate aftermath of Claudius's death and the accession of Nero. But for now, I'd like to end this podcast with my own little encomium to Nook to Claudius. And he's an historical figure for whom I have the utmost admiration. He was, for the most part, and given what went before, that is Caligula, and came after, i.e. Nero, a good emperor. He was a fine administrator, a more than adequate statesman and politician, and an erudite scholar. He wrote histories, grammars, books on the Latin language, and even a book on gambling. He made innovations in the field of document manufacture and oversaw some hugely important infrastructure projects aimed at improving the lives and welfare of his subjects. Yes, he liked to drink. Yes, he loved to play dice. And yes, he had an eye for the ladies. But I, for one, feel those things in no way detract from an extremely clever man who became emperor because he had to, because the alternative would have been to watch his nephew Caligula wreck the Roman state. And it's a shame that Claudius's last throw of the dice turned up a poor score, because I personally feel he'd foreseen what a mistake it would be to make Nero his heir. And it's a shame he didn't realise it in time, just how huge a mistake that would prove. And as for Seneca, well, his relationship with Claudius was a strange one. In many ways, they were very familiar. Both highly educated, both very intelligent men of letters, both plagued by physical afflictions that tormented them throughout their lives and meant that neither could endure the hardships of a long-term military career. And despite the attempts of many ancient commentators and various scholars down the ages to make it sound otherwise, I can find no solid evidence that Seneca actively disliked Claudius. Some sources suggest that Seneca never forgave Claudius for giving in to Messalina and having him exiled to Corsica for 8 odd years on charges of adultery with Julia Livilla. But Seneca himself wrote that Claudius was the only person to speak up for him in the Senate when the charges were being laid, and through his influence as emperor, managed to get the sentence mitigated from execution to exile. And in addition to that, there's a literary evidence. Throughout his entire and extensive extant prose corpus, Seneca never openly criticizes Claudius, even when writing well after that emperor's death. There's only one passage that comes close to open criticism, in which Claudius is compared unfavorably with the great Augustus, but even there the comparison is not insulting. And that's telling, because Seneca's works are full of open vitriol and scathing comment on Claudius's predecessor, Caligula. See, even the apocolicentosis, the lapoon, can't be held up as some kind of literary revenge against Claudius, because it was written as a piece of political propaganda and circulated anonymously as a comical satire during the Saturnalia, in which lampoon and exaggeration were both expected and actively encouraged. So no, in my opinion, Seneca did not hate Claudius. I personally would like to think that the two men may even have admired one another. But that being said, Seneca could never be Claudius's man. In AD 54, Seneca had only one mistress. He was loyal to only one person, and what she said went When Agrippina told Seneca to jump, he asked how high. It was, of course, in his own interests to do so, because with Claudius out of the way, Seneca's charge, Nero, ascended the throne, and that meant that Seneca was catapulted overnight from tutor to a prince to advisor to an emperor. Seneca's star was riding high. And as for Agrippina, if she, backed by her henchman Burrus and political mouthpiece Seneca, thought that life as the power behind the throne was going to be easy, then she had another think coming, because Nero had ideas of his own. I'll hopefully see you in the next podcast.